it looks like a rather large explosion coincided with the tsunami.
A deadly tsunami sweeps over part of Indonesia. It's Monday, December 24th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, crocodile hunters on the move in Australia. The U.S. government shutdown explained. Climate change for truffles. A visit to the world's largest Christmas store. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A tsunami that struck late Saturday has killed over 200 people along Indonesia's Sunda Straits. A spokesman for Indonesia's National Disaster Agency said 222 people are dead, 843 people are injured, and 28 people are missing. Casualties are expected to rise. Robin Andrews is a London-based volcanologist and science writer. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked him what led to the tsunami.
The idea is that, so in the Sunda Strait, you've got Anak Krakatoa, which is the child of Krakatoa, and it's essentially the descendant of the original. And it's a very active volcano, and it's been erupting for a while, and it looks like a rather large explosion coincided with the tsunami. And what people think is that part of the volcano either fell into the sea or something already underwater sort of moved forward as magma kind of intruded into the volcano, and that caused a tsunami. And satellite imagery that I've seen in the last couple of hours quite clearly show that a part of the volcano is now missing. So it seems very likely that this was a volcanically triggered tsunami, and it was not related to any sort of tectonics or earthquake.
Was there any way of predicting such a thing happening?
No, not really, because even though this phenomenon is certainly being studied at various volcanoes around the world, the idea of this sort of volcanic flank collapse or this sort of landslide, the problem with this is not only that the event that caused it is very unpredictable, or we think caused it is very unpredictable, but even if you had a buoys trying to measure the change in the tide and wave height and so forth, it was already so close to the shore that there was, the warning you would have sent out to people would have been so short, if any at all. So it really highlights how quite unpredictable and dangerous these things are, because, it's just very hard to kind of work out when they will happen. And there really is no warning system that exists that can do that at present.
We have read that there was no warning whatsoever, no earthquake, and the tsunami just came ashore. Why is that? Why was there no warning whatsoever in a natural sense, not sirens going off, but an earthquake or any kind of indication that something was about to happen?
So when you normally have, when you have a tectonic tsunami, tectonically generated tsunami, like the one in Sulawesi in September, you normally get a very long period of shaking, and people on the beaches then reported feeling that, and then the tsunami arrived afterwards. The problem here is that it wasn't generated by an earthquake. It was generated by what looks like to be an underwater landslide triggered by the volcanic activity. And the only indication that any of this was happening was that the volcano was, very active at this time. It's been erupting since June. It looks like there was a powerful explosion just before the tsunami. But that doesn't necessarily mean that anything's happened. I mean, that's just a volcano doing what it's doing. But that wouldn't generate any sort of earthquake-like sort of tremors. You wouldn't feel the shaking. And someone I spoke to who was sitting on the beach at the time, who was photographing the eruption, said that he didn't feel anything. He just suddenly saw the waves come in. And he had to, he's very lucky to be alive. He had to scarf it pretty quick. So with this sort of event, you wouldn't feel shaking in the way you would with like an earthquake generated tsunami, which made it particularly dangerous in the sense that even though it was kind of a modest tsunami, it wasn't a huge one, it did clearly take people by surprise.
Anything we haven't covered here that you think is salient to this conversation?
I mean, I think it's important, as with all these events, that sort of, you know, disseminating the correct information is the best thing anyone can do, because with all these sort of events, there's a lot of misinformation that gets spread either maliciously or accidentally. You know, trusted journalists and official sources are the best places to go to. I would add that it's actually quite a shame that there is a partial government shutdown in the US, because the United States Geological Survey, which I think is one of the best scientific agencies in the world, can't comment on what's happening at the moment, because it's only got a skeleton crew and they're not doesn't look like they're permitted to use their social media channels. And as a journalist, I find their commentary very enlightening, and their data will obviously help, you know, efforts in Indonesia. And although scientists in Indonesia are incredible and they're doing their best to kind of communicate things to the public, it is a shame that, you know, America's leading geoscience agency can't sort of take part at the moment.
Could that have saved some lives?
I wouldn't say that. I would just say that, you know, from what I can tell, it's, you know, when there's a disaster like this, it really helps to have everyone who could help on hand. So it's a shame that a major player in the sort of geoscience community can't partake at the moment. They've just got a skeleton crew. But saying that, the Indonesian authorities are doing like an amazing job trying to communicate. You know, they've got many press releases out. They're trying to get the data as clear as possible, and you know, they deserve a lot of respect too. But yeah, it's a bit of a shame that the USGS can't take part properly at the moment because of the shutdown.
Robin Andrews, a London-based volcanologist and science writer, and indeed the website for the U.S. Geological Survey, has a banner reading, "Due to a lapse in appropriations, the majority of USGS websites may not be up to date and may not reflect current conditions. Websites displaying real-time data, such as earthquake and water and information needed for public health and safety, will be updated with limited support. Additionally, USGS will not be able to respond to inquiries until appropriations are enacted." Stay with VOA Asia as we hear more about what is behind the partial U.S. government shutdown. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. 222 dead, hundreds injured as tsunami strikes Java and Sumatra Islands. China holds second vice ministerial to call with U.S. on trade. Nissan CEO case shines light on Japan justice system. Australia and United States accuse China of global cyber espionage. Project launched to repel insects damaging Rohingya shelters in Cox's Bazar. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. Stop by our voanews.com website as well. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Crocodile hunters in the Australian state of Queensland will be allowed to legally collect reptile eggs in the wild and hatch them for luxury goods following a change in conservation laws by the federal government. The move is being seen as a welcome economic boost for remote indigenous communities. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Hunters can now apply for a permit to collect crocodile eggs from nests in the wild. They'll be sold to private farms, hatched and grown for their meat and skins, which are made into luxury leather goods, including boots and handbags. A premium crocodile skin can be worth about $700. The fearsome saltwater crocodile is the world's largest living reptile and was almost hunted to extinction before it became a protected species in Australia in the early 1970s. Collectors will have to adhere to strict guidelines to ensure local crocodile populations are not adversely affected. The Queensland State Government will allow a maximum of 5,000 eggs to be taken each year. John Lever runs a crocodile farm near the city of Rockhampton. He says the decision to allow egg harvesting will boost the local economy.
Aboriginal communities have got a resource of crocodile eggs that they can now sell. Landowners, graziers, if they've got crocodiles on their properties, a lot of these guys think crocodiles are vermin because they're not worth anything and they eat their calves or their foals. And now they've got an economic incentive to keep crocodiles on their place. This is conservation through commerce.
Charlie Manolis is the chief scientist at Wildlife Management International, a private research company based in the northern Australian city of Darwin. He also believes the decision to allow hunters to collect eggs will help to sustain crocodile numbers.
In every case where there was a crocodile egg harvest, the populations in those countries had increased substantially. It's not just about taking eggs for commercial purposes, it's also for government. It's about creating those incentives to have crocodiles. And the best way to conserve crocodiles is really to make them valuable to the community.
The collection of crocodile eggs was made legal in Australia's Northern Territory in the 1980s. Federal authorities have approved changes to environmental legislation in Queensland state after receiving a detailed wildlife trade management plan. The saltwater crocodile was hunted extensively in the wild throughout northern Australia during the 1940s, 50s and 60s. Adult males are on average 5 metres long and weigh more than 450 kilograms. They were protected in Australia in the 1970s. The population is estimated to be between 100,000 and 200,000. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Nissan's former chairman will still be behind bars come Christmas after a Tokyo court on Sunday added another 10 days to his detention. On Friday, Japanese prosecutors unveiled a new set of allegations alleging he manipulated Nissan into bearing the costs for $16 million in his personal investment losses. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. A group of 11 women tried to worship at a Hindu temple in southern India Sunday morning, but were barred by protesters. They were stopped by hundreds of devotees, including other women, who object to the group entering the place of worship in Kerala State, even though the Indian Supreme Court has ruled that the women of childbearing age can enter the shrine. Women have been traditionally banned from entering Sabarimala, one of Hindus' religion's holiest temples. In September, however, the Supreme Court, in a landmark ruling, overturned the long-standing ban on women aged 10 to 50 from entering the temple. The police are trying to negotiate a solution in their talks with the women and the devotees who oppose the women entering the shrine. Some Hindu adherents argue that the court ruling ignores their belief that the deity Ayyappa was reputed to have been celibate. The Supreme Court is scheduled in January to hear challenges to its ruling. Coming up, does the U.S. government actually close? You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, cleanup and recovery continues following a tsunami that struck late Saturday, killing over 200 people along Indonesia's Sunda Straits. Casualties are expected to rise. An eruption of the nearby Krakatoa volcano is thought to be responsible for the tsunami, which struck a short time later. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the U.S. government is partially shut down, affecting many services to the U.S. public and some accessed around the world. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins us to explain what this means.
For a portion of the federal government, non-essential services are suspended while there is a funding lapse, which began on Friday at midnight when U.S. spending authority expired, and Congress and President Trump had yet to put anything in place to extend that funding. Most critical operations do go on. The U.S. military is still doing what militaries do, and here at Voice of America, so are we, at least those of us who have been deemed essential.
Fortunately for those at home, holiday packages will still be delivered by the post office, and also Social Security recipients and other benefit folks will receive their money as well.
They will indeed, but some Americans may notice certain things. If they want to visit certain national parks, they may find that the gates are closed. And in other areas, there may be operations that are continuing, but with a much reduced staff. And so everything goes much slower.
Well, the focus of the shutdown, obviously, is how it becomes resolved. And we have a standoff right now between lawmakers and the president on how that is going to happen. What is happening mechanically, if you will, on Capitol Hill?
Absolutely nothing. They have gone home for the Christmas holiday. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that the Senate will reconvene for business on Thursday, December 27th. So nothing is going to be resolved between now and then. And even then, it's difficult to see how something happens quickly, because what you have is a president who is absolutely determined to secure some kind of funding to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. And you have a Democratic caucus, and which, even though they're in the minority, can torpedo legislation. And that Democratic minority is saying not one dime for a wall. And in between a determination to absolutely have wall funding and not one dime, that doesn't leave a lot of room for negotiation.
It appeared last week that the administration was going to seek other avenues for funding the wall, and that quickly dissolved. And what Trump once said was his shutdown has now become the Democrats' shutdown.
Well, it was a little over a week ago that President Trump had a very famous White House encounter where he invited the press corps in with the Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, the incoming, soon-to-be, and former Speaker of the House of Representatives. And Donald Trump indeed declared that he would be proud to shut the government down, that having a wall built was something that absolutely needed to happen, and that he would own a shutdown if one occurred. Now that we actually have a shutdown, his tone and his words have changed, and he's suggested that if only Democrats would go along with this wall funding, that all would be well. Jim, let me just give you a little bit of background on this, because the argument that the president is making is that Democrats are absolutely inflexible when it comes not just to the wall, but to overall funding for border security, that they won't approve any additional funds. In fact, the Democrats have already gone on record supporting a $1.6 billion increase in overall border security funding that would not be earmarked specifically for the wall, but would include some other measures. And if you look back in history, in fact, Democrats were willing to approve some funding for a wall earlier this year in return for protections for undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States as children, typically called the Dreamers. And there was thought to be a deal in the works. And President Trump expressed great sympathy for the Dreamers and said that he would be happy to sign off on a deal like that. And a few days later, he backed out.
As we know, the true art of the deal in negotiations is both sides get a little bit of something to get something done.
We shall see if it happens this time. In the meantime, we shall endure the shutdown.
We will indeed, paid or unpaid, at least they've assured us we will be at some point. We're always glad to have Michael Bowman with us, our Senate correspondent. And Michael,
a pleasure.
Happy shutdown.
Thank you.
This news from VOA Asia. Beloved Japanese Emperor Akihito has released his final annual birthday statement before he abdicates the throne in April, the first Japanese monarch to do so in 200 years. Sunday marked his 85th birthday. Emperor Akihito acknowledged the countless lives lost in World War II. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, human-impacted climate change is expected to get more severe in the coming years. Get ready for more extreme weather, more floods, more droughts, more hurricanes. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us for some top chefs around the world, climate change is about to impact the market for the most prized fungus in the world.
Products made with truffles are already expensive. For people who love them, these prized lumps of smelly fungus can turn a plate of pasta into a sublime taste experience. They live underground, require specially trained dogs or pigs to find them, and have a very specific growing cycle.
For this winter truffle, the critical period for it are the summer months. And the truffle starts to form at the end of winter, beginning of spring, and then it grows very slowly over the summer months, and it's growing and swelling. And then it matures when you come into the next winter, and that's when we harvest and eat them.
Thomas is the author of a new study that predicts that as climate change heats up, truffles will be in trouble.
And under climate change, and what we see actually in years when it's very warm and very dry, that stops those truffle bodies from growing and swelling. So you don't get production. So under these climate change models, we're going to see a lot less soil moisture, a lot less precipitation, and higher temperatures.
Not just a little trouble. The new study predicts that in many truffle habitats, the tasty fungi could just disappear.
We looked at two climate change models. We looked at the most likely one, and then we looked at one which is a nicer scenario. It's less warming and it's less drying. And between the two scenarios, though, we're still looking at a decline in production of between 78 and 100% of the yield of that territory. So it's a massive drop.
And there's no way to make up for that shortfall. So if you think truffles are expensive now, just wait.
And we see in drought years and years when we have very high temperatures, there's less supply and the prices just increase. So that's going to continue to happen. I'm sure they're going to get very, very expensive going forward.
In drought years, truffle prices can reach up to $2,500 a kilogram. And Thomas says to expect prices to rise to at least that level. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
At more than one hectare under just one roof, Bronner's Christmas Wonderland promotes itself as the largest Christmas store in the world. Erica Celeste visited the store in Frankenmuth, Michigan, for a tour through the eyes of some of its smallest customers, children.
Wow, this is really
wow.
Visiting Bronner's Christmas Wonderland is more than a shopping trip. It's an experience. At roughly the size of 8 Olympic swimming pools, it's a lot for siblings Rollin and Rain Martorello to grasp.
It's huge. That's all I can say. It's really huge.
A trip to Bronner's often starts with a commemorative photo. From there, customers are given a map to help navigate the store. Dazzling lights and outdoor decor cascade from the ceilings that had to be raised to accommodate the taller Christmas tree displays. Rollins says he likes the old-fashioned Dickens characters, Christmas villages, and nutcrackers that cover the showroom floor. But the modern electronic displays are the best.
My favorite thing is the one turned on.
We have over 50,000, just over 50,000 items here. Everything from artificial trees and wreaths and garlands, all kinds of lighting, the LED lights. We have ornaments. We have about 8,000 styles of ornaments. About 1,500 of those can be personalized.
In fact, says Media Relations Chief Lori Lipka, the ornaments are the stars of the store. Everything from hand-blown glass baubles to sports theme pieces and even movie motif ornaments. A definite favorite are the international ornaments, which makes sense because the store guestbook reflects visitors from more than 100 countries.
We do see a lot of international folks, and it's not unusual to walk around and to hear several languages being spoken any given day this time of year.
Because the store is open 361 days a year, it's the one place kids of all ages can get a little Christmas anytime they want.
What do I do then?
For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Frankenmuth, Michigan.
We hope your hunt for holiday gifts has been going well. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can also find us on VOA Asia Facebook, a great place to stream our program if you'd like to hear the entire program. And if you miss any part of it, just go to our website, voanews.com, where we have today's full-length program, plus programs of days past if you'd like to listen to those as well. We'd also like to thank everybody who is listening via the radio. Chiang Mai University. Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University in Thailand carries our program. Thanks to everyone there who is tuned in today. And our thanks go out to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Aiden Utku, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.